Hey, Paul, I have a fish that can break dance.
The listeners at home, Watto's so excited about this one.
But he could only do it, Paul, he could only do it for 10 seconds, and he could only do it once.
I don't understand.
It's because the fish dies. Okay. I have to explain this to you. Paul, you take a fish out of water, you put it down, it looks like it's breakdancing.
I see.
But dying.
So it's a story about murdering a fish. Okay.
I'm not going to do it for real. It's just a...
just an amusing anecdote.
only for 10 seconds and only once. Oh, my gosh. All right, Paul, let me try one more.
All right.
When my Uncle Frank died, he wanted his remains to be buried in his favorite beer mug.
Okay.
So I guess you could say his last wish was to be Frankenstein.
All right, that's pretty good.
I like it. The fish one, I think you didn't get it.
That one really did it for you. You were giddy before we started rolling.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cash Like More Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders. I'm Dr. Matthew Frank Watto, here with my great friend and America's primary care physician, Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Hey, Paul.
Hey, Matt. How are you?
You know, I feel a little slighted, but we'll get through it. You didn't like the puns.
Famously humorless. Like that. This is all on me.
All right. So we have a great episode to recap. Number 458, heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, or HFrEF, as Paul likes to call it, with Dr. Michelle Kittleson, returning guest, and production by Dr. Deb Gorth and infographic by Zoya Serrani. So, Paul, let's start off with when we find someone with heart failure, what's the most important question to ask ourselves first?
It would be great to know why this person has heart failure, Matt.
Yes.
because that may actually guide some of the treatments you actually provide for the patient. So if you know why it happened, that actually may impact some of the therapies that you have to offer someone. So if someone has a new cardiomyopathy, some of the times it's obvious, some of the times it's less obvious. So is it worth, you know, case-by-case basis, obviously you're not going to do the $1 million click all the button workup for every single patient, but is there family history? Is there reason to suspect iron overload? Do they have underlying thyroid disease? Is there a history of heavy alcohol use? Or could it be amyloid? Are they giving you a great history of bilateral carpal tunnel and they have heart failure? And on and on and on. So it's worth actually thinking about why the heart failure is there first. And then you can go buck wild with your guideline-directed medical therapy, but that may actually change a little bit in terms of how you work it up and what things you do next.
And everyone always likes to ask about BNP. And we talked about this with Dr. Kittleson again. So she said it is a great thing that you can check if you're trying to make the initial diagnosis. It can be helpful in that setting. As far as once you know someone has heart failure, when someone's being admitted to the hospital, if the BNP is above 5,000, that can be a poor prognosticator. So it does have prognostic value. But as far as trending the BNP over time and using it to make treatment decisions, that is not something that's recommended. Nor does it work. We treat the patient clinically. You know, how are they feeling? Are they decongested or not? You should not just keep diuresing the person until the BNP goes back to the normal range. That does not happen, and that is not recommended. So, Paul, let's get into talking about treatment, because this is really where we spent most of the episode. Remind people, what are the four pillars of guideline-directed, not goal-directed? This cardiologists get really bent out of shape about that, don't they, Paul?
Yeah, between that and metoprolol tartrate, God help you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, yeah. Thanks for asking, Matt. Dr. Kittleson is who better to tell us about these things. But so the four big pillars, just to remind you, there is the angiotensin pathway inhibitors, and that includes the ARNIs, which really are the first line and really one of the first medications you should be reaching for. if for whatever reason, either they're not tolerated or medication expense or that kind of thing, the next in line would be ACE inhibitor, actually. And I'm just going to pause here and speak to all the residents whom I precept, none of whom probably actually listen to this, but we're talking heart failure, kids. So ARBs for blood pressure, but for heart failure, apparently ACE has a little bit more evidence than ARBs, and then ARBs would be next in line. So ARNIs, ACE inhibitors, ARBs in rank order for the angiotensin pathway inhibitors. The next big pillar, Matt, is the beta blockers. So metoprolol, succinate, God help you if it's metoprolol tartrate and the cardiologist sees them, because then you'll just earn their sneering disdain. Carvedilol twice daily or bisoprolol are all reasonable options for your beta blockade. Third pillar, mineralocorticoid antagonists. So these are spironolactone or eplerenone. And then the fourth pillar, which was not even in some of the studies that actually sort of guided our principles, are the SGLT2 inhibitors, Matt, the new kids on the block that are good for everything, diabetes, now heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, reducing gout, all the things. So things like empagliflozin, dapagliflozin, those are the medications that we should also be reaching for relatively early just because they're so effective and have such great outcomes associated with them.
And we talked about the strong heart failure trial, which was this trial where they started all the patients on guideline-directed medical therapy right at the time of diagnosis or during the hospitalization. And over a six-week period, they tried to get them up to goal on all the agents. She mentioned that SGLT2 inhibitors weren't included because they just weren't really around at that time, at least for this indication. But the patients in the group that were that had usual care had worse outcomes than the patients who were rapidly initiated on these medications and gotten them up to speed. And it was like an 8% absolute risk reduction, which is a huge absolute risk reduction. And it just took about 6 months to be able to see that risk reduction. So this is you get the benefits of this therapy pretty quickly compared to some things. You know, we say, compared to some things where we're talking about multiple years to reap the benefits of medication. Paul, what about the practicality of starting these medications? Are you seeing this done nowadays?
I am. Yeah, they tend to be, I'm seeing them, Matt, at least started on hospitalized patients. So usually by the time they come to me for outpatient follow-up, they have been started on most of these medications. We were talking before in a different context. It used to be, I feel like the beta blocker was sort of thrown in there and patients were diuresis and the rest was kind of where the chips fall where they may. But now I'm seeing them started during the inpatient and including some insurance negotiation just to make sure the patients can afford them when they actually arrive for primary care follow-up. And Dr. Kittleson talked a little bit, Matt, I was going to touch on what order to sort of start in. But in general, I just want to say that she starts them in sequence and not all at the same time, just because that way she can actually determine which side effect is the most bothersome to a patient should they happen to experience them. So something, if an electrolyte goes wonky or if they experience significant fatigue or they have other signs of intolerance, we know which medication to blame. But you start them still relatively quickly, but in sequence and not just all at the same time.
Yeah. And I think that's really smart. And the sequence in which to start them, she likes to start the ones that might make the patient feel better first. So there's a couple reasons not to start the beta blocker first. Some people just don't feel as well when they take beta blockers. And also you want to make sure the patient is well decongested before you start the beta blocker. You don't want to start it while they're still acutely decompensated and super congested. But otherwise, the ARNI, ACE, or ARB would be a good potential one to start first. And also thinking about it as like spending the blood pressure, right? A lot of patients with systolic heart failure have lower blood pressures that are on the lower side. And getting on that ACE, ARB, or ARNI as that first line is a good way to spend some of that blood pressure. And if you get that one on, when you add an MRA or you add like an SGLT2 inhibitor in the context of heart failure, those two don't tend to have as much of a blood pressure lowering effect. We're not talking about like the person with like primary hyperaldo where you're adding the MRA where it does have a big drop in blood pressure. Paul, that's kind of the approach to it. And then you're sort of checking weekly labs, you're checking in with the patient every week or two to make sure that how are they feeling? What do the labs look like? Do we have room to go up on the medications? And the goal is to get them there within about 6 weeks.
Yeah. And Dr. Kittleson makes the point, and there are other bad prognostic features that we can talk about a little bit later on, but in this particular instance, if someone has an intolerance to guideline directed medical therapy, if there's you know, you're trying to add on all four classes and the patient just can't do it, whether because they feel awful or because of, they just don't have the blood pressure to sustain it. Pretty bad prognostic indicator. And yeah, that you should be thinking about having that person follow with the heart failure specialist probably at that point.
So if the person, you know, we asked her about cost, right? Because that is a big issue, especially our Medicare patients. And I just saw something today, Paul, that that's going to be hopefully changing around the time this is coming out in early 2025. Supposedly, they're going to be changing some of the Medicare donut hole rules and the out-of-pocket costs are going to be capped at like $2,000 instead of $8,000 or something. But so hopefully that'll be the case because the ARNIs, the SGLT2s are very expensive. So she said in that case, well, if the patient can only afford either the ARNI or the SGLT2, since the ACE inhibitors are pretty good and the ARNI's incrementally better, she would start with the ACE inhibitor and spend the money on the SGLT2 because the MRAs, those are also cheap. Right. Beta blockers are also cheap. So, you know, that's kind of the workaround if they only have money to spend on one of the more expensive medications. But Paul, what if they're only on two or three pillars? What's a good way to just figure out why they're not on all four pillars? She gave us a little bit of, like, I guess, EHR chart searching tips.
I'm not sure specifically what you're referring to. She talked about sort of going back and doing the chart biopsy and finding out why a medication was discontinued and sort of checking on that, which is one of my favorite things to do in general, yeah, sort of digging deep into the medical record and trying to find sort of bits of minutia. So you can always go back in a medication history and see, I say always, depending on what system that you're using, often you can go back in the medication history and see what was prescribed and even when it was discontinued and cross-reference that to the progress note or the encounter that happened at that time and try to figure those things out. And it really is worth doing because patients do so much better on these medications than not, unless there's a really compelling indication to not have them on it.
And what I was getting at is in the chart biopsy, but if you keyword search it, so, you know, there's a search bar in most of the EHRs, and if you just search for, you know, eplerenone or spironolactone, you know, it would find the note like that might explain why that was discontinued or something like that. That's what she mentioned as a pro tip for you people out there that have, I guess, if you're fortunate enough to have an EHR with the search bar, you can do that.
Congratulations to you.
All right, Paul. So we talked about, and this was a big question, we even got questions after the episode about this. Paul, I'm gonna do that thing where I say something that's probably wrong and then you're gonna correct me. my patient, their EF was down 10%. It was down at 10%. I put them on GDMT, rapid sequence initiation. I titrated them up. 3 months later, they feel great. They're doing great. We get another echo. Their EF is now 55%. Me and the patient high five, and I take their medication bottles and throw them in the trash and say, go with God. Is that a mistake?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there's a lot of things in there that are probably suspect, including the high five. But yeah, I think what you're getting at, Matt, is the temptation to deprescribe once someone is doing better, especially if their ejection fraction improves after guideline-directed medical therapy, which is kind of what you want to see. If you start someone on the medications and they feel better and their cardiac function improves, that means the medications are working. So the understandable gut impulse would be to then start deprescribing because we as primary care doctors love fewer medications, not more, despite popular opinion. But in this instance, there have been studies, I think it's the TREAD-HF study that looked at patients in this exact scenario. And it turns out that if you stop the guideline-directed medical therapy, those patients do worse and lose all the progress that they've made. So once you've got someone feeling better and they've had improvement in their ejection fraction, stay the line, hold the course, keep the medications where they're at, because it means they're doing the thing they're supposed to be doing.
Yeah. So a couple miscellaneous things. We asked about hydralazine and isosorbide. And she mentioned that was a very narrow indication. And generally, most patients on guideline, like on the full GDMT, guideline-directed therapy, they are feeling well and they don't necessarily need that medication. So that medication she sort of reserves, and she said this is like less than 1% of her patients. She reserves that for patients who are on the full GDMT at, you know, the max tolerated doses, and they're still having symptoms or they're still having, you know, blood pressure that's not fully controlled, that would be a reason to potentially reach for that. But that's not a common situation. Similarly, Paul, ivabradine, remember she talked about that, where if patients are on max tolerated dose of beta blocker and, you know, the heart rate's still uncontrolled, that would be a time you might reach for that. But Paul, are you reaching for these on your own anymore?
No, am I reaching for the ivabradine, a medication I just pronounced correctly for the first time this very podcast? No, these are medications for someone is already on the maximally tolerated doses. And again, if you have someone who's still struggling and not doing well on the maximal doses of guideline-directed medical therapy, probably they should be seeing a heart failure specialist, yeah, and they'll be the ones who are pulling the trigger on that. Same with vericiguat?
I think you got that. I think you got it, yeah.
It felt right. Is another one that has some narrow indications that, again, not something I'll be pulling the trigger on because I just...
Right.
It's for someone who's not doing well and they're already on all the right medications.
Yeah. Yeah, they're still having exacerbations despite GDMT. You might think about that one. But again, that's not really for us. We talked about defibrillators. I think most people know by now you're giving them at least a three-month trial of GDMT, rechecking the EF, because many times it will come up and you don't want to put a defibrillator in somebody if they don't need it. So that's it. And I guess one of the last questions we asked her was about salt. And she talked that she's not super dogmatic about that. She talks to people and says, well, you know, some people just know that they're more salt sensitive, that they're going to swell up if they eat a bunch of salt. Other people are not. And so she's not really super strict. It's hard to eat just, especially in the United States, it's hard to eat just a 2 gram or 2,000 milligrams of sodium a day. So she doesn't really guilt people or shame them too much about that. I don't know, Paul, if you have anything else to say about that, but I thought that was reassuring to say, because it's not something that I'm really talking about too much with my patients anymore.
No, I mean, I think we've talked about this on prior episodes. It's not something I'm terribly militant about. If someone is eating a lot of high sodium foods, certainly I'll do some counseling education, like if there's a lot of canned or frozen foods. And
yeah.
But in general, it's not something I spend the most time on, because I think, Matt, you actually made this point a million years ago, that if someone is so tenuous that a hot dog just throws them into a decompensation, like it's not, their natural history is not looking great no matter sort of what their diet looks like. So I think moderation is the key, and it's good to educate but not be too dogmatic about it.
Yeah. And if you can get your patient eating like a healthy diet, like fruits and vegetables, it's usually lower sodium just by doing that. So that's usually where I talk about. I don't directly talk about the low sodium. All right, Paul. Well, I think we've done a great job recapping this episode, and the audience would agree. But
yeah, no,
let's
sure.
Let's answer some listener questions. So, and again, these are both pertinent to this episode. So Kelsey R. asks, I'd love to know your thoughts on ED follow-ups and how your process goes for this. Thanks. So Paul, you're America's PCP. How do your ED follow-ups go? Maybe it doesn't have to be specifically for heart failure, but I'm sure you're getting follow-ups from the hospital or the emergency department for heart failure on occasion.
Yeah, I mean, I think I wasn't sure if this question is specifically for heart failure or just for ED follow-ups in general, but I feel like a lot of institutions have processes in place to ensure there is short-term follow-up. There's usually a communication, at least in my medical record, that someone has been seen in the emergency department, and I think our support staff do a great job of sort of scrubbing the charts and seeing if someone needs a transition of care or sort of post-discharge visit. And it usually kind of happens behind the scenes. I do personally try to peek in and just sort of see if someone needs to be seen or not, but for the most part, blessedly, it kind of happens without me, and it may not always be with me, but sometimes it's with our staff. So I don't know. This is not a very satisfying answer, but I'm lucky enough to work in a large enough institution where there's infrastructure in place to make sure it happens when it's appropriate. And I provide a little bit of oversight by doing chart checks.
We have a very similar process to what you're saying. Again, I'm in a larger institution, so there's people are reaching out to patients. There's a lot of sharing of information in the Philadelphia area through the electronic health record. So I get notifications even if they're admitted to one of the other or visit the emergency department in one of the other local hospitals. So I'll kind of peek in and see what it was. And if we haven't reached out yet and it seems something important, I'll try to bring the person in. So it just depends. It depends on the situation. But if it's something serious and I think they would benefit from a visit, then I'll do a visit. Sometimes I'll do telemed. Sometimes I'll bring them in. Just depends on the availability.
as much as you're able to, and I know this is easier said than done, and this feels very patent cliche, but if you can get to know your ER colleagues, it is really, really helpful. I will say that one of the places that I worked, I was very familiar with them. They knew me because I'd been there for forever. And so if there was any kind of concern, I would get a phone call like, is it okay if I send this person home? Can you see them in the short term? Or do you think it's appropriate to keep this person? So like if you have enough of a relationship with enough staff, sometimes you can actually sort of help them triage the appropriate follow-up, which is also feels great, even before that notification comes through.
Paul, two more questions, but both of them are about SGLT2 inhibitors. So one from Ryan and one from John Segielski. I don't know, Paul, what do you think? How do you think you pronounce that name?
Segielski, I would probably
Segielski, okay. That's probably how you say it then. All right, so Ryan says, what would you say to do with an SGLT2 in a patient who's on it for GDMT for HFpEF and they have recurrent UTIs and saying that the UA didn't have any glucose on it? Would you hold it briefly? Would there be, you know, and thinking, is it weird that there wasn't glucosuria and wasn't really finding data on it? So I will say, as far as UTIs go specifically, the data on that has been mixed, whether or not whether or not SGLT2 inhibitors actually cause UTIs. So I think initially there was concern about this, so there was some labeling about it. But when they've actually looked at it in like meta-analyses, it wasn't clear whether or not it actually does increase the risk of UTI. It definitely does increase the risk of mycotic genital infections, which we've talked about on previous episodes. So I found some stuff on that. Paul, I wanted to, and, you know, looking into whether or not it should cause glucosuria. So I'm not sure if this person was fasting and that's why they didn't have glucose in the urine. I mean, that's sort of like, I guess if you gave them like, you know, a sleeve of Oreos, they probably would have glucosuria. But I don't know, Paul, what do you think?
No, I agree with absolutely everything you said, unsurprisingly. Like, yeah, I was just doing a quick search too about the prevalence of glucosuria in patients without diabetes on SGLT2 inhibitors. And it's because I wasn't sure if there's a threshold effect or not. And it turns out you have less sugar in your urine, but in general, you're still going to have sugar in your urine. So it's weird. Like, you do have to wonder about adherence to the medication in the first place. And I agree also with your point about like the cystitis, like the UTIs versus mycotic infections. UTIs, the data are not really strong in one way or the other. Mm-hmm. So kind of a case-by-case basis. The question here is, would you hold it briefly? I don't know. I guess it really depends on sort of how frequently they're happening and sort of how controlled the heart failure is otherwise. I think there's a lot of factors, yeah. So I'm not sure I'd be able to kind of give a specific answer because this feels like a fairly niche circumstance. So it would depend on the patient, I think. I know that's not very satisfying, so sorry, Ryan.
But I did find a really nice paper by Dr. Duvalian from UT Southwestern. And the paper was about mycotic genital infection and UTI and just sort of telling you, they actually made an algorithm for this. So we'll put this in the show notes, but it was really great that basically saying like, you should have, and the gist of the article was have a very high threshold to stop an SGLT2 inhibitor because of mycotic genital infections or UTIs. And have a low threshold to restart it after they get over the UTI or mycotic genital infection. If somebody has an infection and it's very mild, you can treat through it and continue the medication. But if it's like a complicated infection, like let's say a complicated UTI, in that case, they said they would stop it, treat the UTI or genital infection, and then reinitiate it at a later point. So you can kind of look at that article, but it was really great. And they even had like the number needed to treat, number needed to harm, Paul. So the number needed to harm for the genital infections and the UTIs was like in the hundreds. And the number needed to treat for benefit for heart failure admissions, cardiovascular mortality, total mortality was like under 100 for all of those.
Yeah.
So when you kind of look at like the risk reduction, It's there's a really significant risk reduction with these medications for heart failure, and the number needed to treat is much lower than the number needed to harm. So they make a good case for why you should do it. And I checked, Dr. Duvalian is not like it was not funded by like
sure.
I don't know, big SGLT2, at least not that I could tell. So anything else to say about that, Paul?
Yeah, are we lumping these two questions together? Are we going
to? Yeah, and then John's question was more about just like what to do with all these candida and fungal infections. So, Paul, how are you approaching those?
Because I think the two are kind of related. Well, obviously they're related, but I think it's important to do a proactive counseling before starting the medications. And so warning patients that they may experience mycotic infections. I actually have made a part of my practice before initiation to ask about circumcision status when applicable. And not that it changes what I do, but it just changes in terms of how aggressively I counsel about the possibility of balanitis, which I see more often with SGLT2 inhibitors. And same for vulvovaginal candidiasis. Like, I will counsel it as a possibility so that people do not come back mad at me when it happens and I didn't actually warn them about it. Because I think everyone wants to feel better and have their heart failure managed and that kind of stuff. But if it's a known side effect that they're not prepared for, then it's going to be a harder sell sort of after the fact, has been my experience, at least anecdotally. That in terms of what should I be doing in terms of all these pesky infections, I think an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So just really emphasizing the importance of hygiene and keeping areas sort of dry and as much as possible. And then when they actually come up, treating them like I would anybody else who actually has a candidal yeast infection, which, again, not terribly satisfying, but topical therapies to reduce irritation, antifungal medications, that kind of stuff, systemic if it's really, really bad, but usually doesn't get to that point.
Yeah, nothing to add there from me. So, Paul, let's get into our picks of the week. And, Paul, I think I've gone way off the deep end now with my health, wellness, fitness thing. I started wearing some of these barefoot shoes, which definitely are going to take some getting used to. Have you seen these out there?
No, we I've heard of them, but I have not seen them or tried them because sounds like I would just ruin my arches immediately.
If you already have significant foot problems like fasciitis, plantar fasciitis and that sort of thing, then you are probably not going to be able to tolerate these, at least not initially. But these are barefoot shoes. The idea... full disclosure, I was listening to Peter Attia talk to this woman about fall prevention and about like all these kind of problems up the chain, that some of which may start with the feet, and just made a good case for why the shape of the shoes that we wear, like if you look at your foot, like the shape, our foot actually widens at the front, and most shoes in the world narrow at the toe. So we can at least agree on that, I think. And that can actually start to cause bunions. And the big toe is important for balance. So if your big toe is sort of away, your big toe wants to naturally come towards the midline, but it can't in most shoes. So I just got some shoes that are wider in the toe box. And then also they're thinner on the soles, less of a heel to toe drop. And that's supposed to be good for you. So we'll see. But it does take my Achilles, and my calves are more sore. Or I should say my calves. My Achilles aren't sore. My calf muscles have been more sore just initially. So you really have to build up to certainly thinking about running in these. But they are good for weightlifting because you can really sit back in your heels nicely. So Vivo barefoot shoes. Check them out. How about you, Paul?
I, Matt, not surprisingly, do not have a fitness recommendation. I'm going to recommend a new album by Noga Erez. So are you familiar with her at all, Matt?
Mm-mm.
She is an Israeli singer. She's a songwriter. She, I guess, falls under the category of alternative, but I think there's really heavy hip-hop influences. So she put out this album just this year called The Vandalist, which was just released. I'm actually still waiting to buy the vinyl. And the title track itself is awesome. Like, it borrows the bass from Busta Rhymes' "Keep Your Hands Where My Eyes Can See Them,"
and it sort of
builds this amazing groove on top of it. She's got this great sort of sultry voice and really interesting harmonies. Everything's kind of chopped up, and it's hip hoppy, but it has some alternative flavor to it, and also a little bit of Torch Singer behind it. So I've really been enjoying her a lot. So if you're not familiar with her, her name is Noga Erez, Noga Erez. And the album is The Vandalist. She's had some stuff before that was critically very well received as well. But worth checking out if you had not heard yet.
The Vandalist.
Vandalist. Okay. As like Vandalist. A vandal, but someone who does vandalism.
Ah, got it. Okay. Is that why she has her... When I Google search her, she's got like stuff written all over her face in one of these pictures. I don't know if that's the cover to that album. Anyway.
I hesitate to speak for her. That is not the album cover to my knowledge.
Okay. All right. Well, Paul, I think we've done it. I think that is a full episode. We answered.
He solved
we
heart
recapped,
failure.
We recapped heart failure. We answered some listener questions. We gave some picks. I think it's time for an outro.
All right. Well, with all of that, this has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yummy.
You can find show notes at thecurbsiders.com and sign up for our mailing list to get our weekly show notes in your inbox. This would include our Curbsiders Digest, which recaps the latest practice-changing articles, guidelines, and news in internal medicine.
And a special thanks to all of our wonderful patrons. We literally couldn't be doing this show without you. And to our whole Curbsiders team, our technical production is done by Podpaste. Elizabeth Proto does our social media. Jen Watto runs our Patreon. Krista Chumanchu moderates our Discord. Stuart Brigham composed our theme music. And with all that, until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto.
And as always, I remain Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Thank you and goodbye.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.